Okay, so let's start. We're a little bit late. So today we're gonna start more systematically. So let me just tell you a few words. So we said that conformal field theories are QFTs with additional symmetries. And in this course, we're going to systematically study how the symmetries constrain conformal field theories and how consistency conditions allow us to solve, in quotes, these theories using just physical constraints. So whenever you have a physical problem, it's always good to organize it into like a two-step procedure. First, you organize things by making explicit all the symmetries. And you could call this that first you analyze the kinematics and write down the most general thing that's consistent with the kinematics. Okay, so you know this from even from an undergraduate. So if you have a particle in moving in three dimensions and the potential is spherically symmetric, it's useful to use the fact that you have a spherical symmetry. So instead of writing a differential equation for three variables, you only have the radial coordinate. Okay, so that's, you still have to solve the radial coordinate. That's where the dynamics comes in. But by making explicit the kinematics, you have drastically simplified the problem. Okay, or for example, if you have two particles and you have a potential that is and you have a translational symmetry, it would be convenient to use coordinates that depend only on the relative position of the particles, for example, so that something that would look very complicated becomes very simple as it can be once you make explicit the symmetries. And then, so in conformal field theory, we'll have the, since there will be lots of symmetries, the maximum number of symmetries that you can have for a non-trivial theory, the kinematics are going to be very constraining on what are the actual physical observables in these theories. And we still have to compute them using something else, and that's where the dynamics will come in. So kinematics doesn't tell you the answer to a problem. It parameterizes in the most simple way. And then dynamics determines the answer to the physical problem. And here what we will see is that consistency conditions will be used to essentially get an infinite set of equations for an infinite set of variables that in some sense solve the problem. In two dimensions, they explicitly solve the problem. Okay? And the consistency conditions will be simple physical ones like unitarity, and associativity of the product of operators and things like that. Okay, but in this lecture today, what I'm going to start with. So I told you that you always have to start with step number one. So I'll start with step number one, which is the kinematics. And actually, within kinematics, before we talk about how various symmetries act on your physical variables like fields. Before that, actually, we need to understand how they act on geometry. Okay, so first we're going to study just geometry, how these symmetries act on just pure geometry, and then we will understand how these symmetries act on the operators and the fields in the theory. So we're going to start with the geometry of conformal transformations. And then next lecture, we're going to understand how these are realized on fields and operators and the Hilbert space and blah, blah, blah. Okay? So conformal we're going to discuss a collection of transformations that will be a symmetry eventually of a theory. And it's a general principle in physics that whenever you have a collection of transformations that are the symmetry, they form a group. Okay? So we'll define the conformal group. So this will be the group of symmetries of a conformal field theory, just like rotational invariance gives you the rotation group, or you have the Poincaré group in relativistic quantum field theories. Okay. So a group G. Okay. In this lecture today, we will mostly discuss continuous transformations. transformations connected to the identity. This is to be distinguished from discrete transformations, which have no continuous parameter in it, okay? And a continuous transformation connected to the identity essentially is a transformation that maps one point to a nearby point, okay? It's a small transformation, if you wish. And something that you know in some languages that essentially you have a group, but essentially all the information about the group up to global properties that we will discuss later is essentially contained in the behavior of the transformations close to the identity. Okay? Mathematically, what the statement is that the transformations connected to the identity define a Lie algebra, the Lie algebra of G, of the group of transformations, right? And what is a Lie algebra? Is a set of generators that obey this equation. Okay? Where F, A, B, C are the structure constants of your Lie algebra. And these F, A, B, C have to satisfy certain constraints like the Jacobi identity. So in this lecture, what we're going to describe is actually both, but first we're going to start this kind of finding out what is the Lie algebra, what is a conformal algebra. From here, today we want to describe the conformal algebra. And the basic intuition is that if you know what happens under small transformations, by iterating them many times, you can get a large transformation. So if you know the infinitesimal ones, you know everything. Okay? Good. So these presumably are things that you have seen in some language, but you can ask. I hope you ask questions. Otherwise, I'll just go on. Okay. So let me remind you. So now we want to solve this problem. We want to find all the transformations that are conformal. Okay? In Minkowski space. This problem can also be studied in other space-time geometries, and it's interesting to do so, but for today's lecture, and you will see it's very easy to generalize at least what are the equations that determine the symmetry, the conformal symmetries in a given space-time geometry. Solving them, actually in general, a general manifold will not have any conformal symmetries, just like a random manifold does not have any isometries. Okay? But in flat space, as a flat space is a space that has the maximal number of isometries and conformal symmetries that a space can have, the metric. Okay, so let's. I guess I have to. Okay. Conformal transformations. Remember, these were space-time transformations. So we're going to be in Minkowski space, and in this course I will interchangeably go from Lorentzian to Euclidean signature. There are no real subtleties in unitary conformal field theories and going between Euclidean and Lorentzian signature. By this I mean Minkowski space. So what we're doing is a space-time transformation that maps a point P with coordinates x to another point x with coordinates x tilde, okay? Such that, so it's a coordinate transformation like the ones you've studied in relativity, x mu to, in general it's a nonlinear transformation that maps one point to another point. I mean, an example of this would be a translation, right? It maps this point to that point, or a rotation. That either you can say it in several ways that it preserves the light cones, or it preserves the angles between vectors. So the way you say that is that the line element in flat Minkowski space under this transformation. So you make a transformation from x. Okay, let me write it here. So what you look is the transformations x to x tilde, such that the line element is preserved up to a scale factor. Okay. That's why this is a conformal transformation and not an isometry. And for an isometry, you would preserve the line element that in flat space would define the Poincaré group, the Poincaré transformations. Okay. Clearly, the transformations preserve angles because you have not messed with the isotropy of the metric, but it doesn't preserve distances because you have rescaled the proper length by some cookie factor. Okay. Okay. So now our goal is to completely solve this problem, to find all transformations x tilde that have this property. Okay. Now, naively, we said that there should be an infinite number of them because this Wx can be anything. But this is a lie because, I mean, this Wx has to be generated by a coordinate transformation. Okay. And we will see that this constraint, actually, Wx is essentially determined by the coordinate transformation. So let's write an equation that allows us to process this more systematically. So what does this equation mean more explicitly? And then you will see that we will get equations that you have seen before in the context of Poincaré transformations. So what we have is that this equation means what is the line element. The line element in the transformed coordinates. So this is the Minkowski metric. So a Minkowski metric is preserved up to a factor, scale factor. That's what the conformal transformation is, okay? Now you can write this in a way that is more familiar from things you've seen in general relativity. You can just actually bring this guy down and then say that what we're doing is looking for transformations x tilde that obey this equation. Okay. Now, if this factor was not there, it was just one, this would be exactly the transformation that preserved the Lorentz metric, the Minkowski metric, and you know what the solution of those are. But now we allow this thing. So now here we can see immediately that this function is not an independent function to the coordinate transformation. Let's find it. So one way you can determine this is you can think of this as a matrix equation and take the determinant of this equation on both sides. So you have this Jacobian. So this is the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation. Dx tilde dx is a partial derivative. And if I take the determinant of this equation, I get that the determinant of dx tilde dx, I'm not going to put all the indices, square, because I have two of them, right, equals the determinant on the right-hand side. So this guy is a d by d diagonal matrix. So when I compute the determinant, I get is a product of the eigenvalues. So from here, I'm going to get e to the 2 omega d 2 d omega of x, OK? So that means that e to the omega x essentially is the Jacobian of the transformation. Is that clear? And by this, okay, by this I mean the determinant of the Jacobian. Okay. Good. So this makes it clear that this guy is fixed in terms of the coordinate transformation. Okay. So now let's look at this equation to get some intuition from things that you already know. So one thing I can do is I can bring this guy to the left and make it look almost like something that you know, that you've seen before. So let me define the following. Let's define a matrix R rho mu, which is dx tilde rho dx mu e to the minus omega x, okay? And now this is a function of x. So now the equation that defines a conformal transformation can be written as something that I'm going to write it as a matrix equation without putting all the indices, as r transpose eta r equals eta. Now, what is this? Have you seen these transformations before? The group of transformations that preserve the Minkowski metric is the Lorentz transformations. So this is very useful because it tells you something quite neat. It tells you that the conformal transformation, which looks very exotic, so this implies that the conformal transformation can be thought of. So a conformal transformation is given by this Jacobian factor, right? So now I can undo it. I can write it as this R matrix, which is an orthogonal matrix, times the scale factor. So essentially, what it tells you is that this is a local rotation given by the matrix R rho mu. So unlike the usual Lorentz transformations in which the Lorentz transformation is isotropic, it's the same everywhere, in a conformal transformation, the Lorentz rotation depends on the space-time point x. Okay. So a conformal transformation by this equation tells you that it's a local Lorentz rotation, because that's what a local Lorentz rotation is. Times, I bring this guy here, times a local dilatation, local scaling, local dilatation or a scale transformation. So at least you can have some intuition about it, because you have intuitions about from usual rotations and from scale transformations. So conformal transformation is just a local version of things that you know very well. Okay. Is this clear?
Can you go over that again? Like, how did you go from the first kind to the
second? Oh yes. So I can write. Yes, maybe went a bit too fast. So I can write this as a matrix equation. So let's call this matrix. Okay. So as a matrix equation, it's very similar to the equation I wrote there. So if you want, I can put all the indices back, but that's the basic idea. So this is a D by D matrix. So now take the determinant of this matrix. The determinant of this is the product of the determinants. The determinant of this guy is the same as the determinant of this guy, so it will drop out. The determinant of a matrix and the determinant of the transpose of a matrix is the same. So you get the determinant of this thing E square times the determinant of this matrix, right? But this matrix is a diagonal matrix with entry 1, but it's multiplied by this factor, so you get d factors of d powers of this, right? So that's what I wrote here. Okay. Good. So this is the general equation that we need to solve. If you want to find out, and if you wish, you can plug this here. So you don't have this omega, and everything is written in terms of x tildes. Okay. This equation would define the most general conformal transformation. Okay. It can be connected to the identity, as I was describing here. So it's a small transformation, close to doing nothing, or can include also. It includes all of them. It includes also things that are not connected to the identity. Can someone tell me an example of a transformation that's connected, that's not connected to the identity, that preserves the Lorentz metric? Time reversal, yeah? Or parity, for example, that would be an example. So we will have to worry about the analogs of parity and time reversal in the context of conformal transformations. But first, we're interested in unraveling the conformal algebra. So in order to do that, we just have to look at the small transformations. Okay. So now let's go under the. So I want to determine the goal is to determine the infinitesimal transformations that fix the conformal algebra, and then up to global issues determine the conformal group. Okay. So how are we going to do this? So look, what we do is we look at infinitesimal transformations. So what we write is the transformation x maps does nothing up to a small part. So this wouldn't do anything, right? It maps the point x tilde to x, so it would leave it fixed. But now we allow a small transformation that maps it by some vector that we will consider small, okay? And the way geometrically you should think about this is that zeta mu is a space-time vector field. Zeta, so the vector field zeta, whose components in the coordinate x look like this. I mean, I believe this is a thing you must have seen in general relativity or as an undergraduate or something like that, yeah. Okay, so now what we want to do is find all such zetas that define a conformal transformation. So the way we're going to do this is straightforward. What you do is you look at the defining equation and just look at it for infinitesimal transformation. Okay, so what is this? So this will be, so I just have to take some partial derivative. So here I will get delta rho mu plus d zeta mu, sorry, d zeta rho mu, delta sigma nu plus d nu zeta sigma equals, okay, so now here, okay, so here I remember that so this factor, this was dx tilde, dx over 2d, right? Now, can someone tell me if I make a infinitesimal, so imagine I want to compute this is a determinant, right? What is this for an infinitesimal transformation where x tilde is x plus, x plus zeta? Can someone tell me what that is? Sorry? It's related to the trace, but yeah, more explicitly. I mean, essentially, the way you can derive this is by knowing that the determinant of a matrix is the same as the exponential of the trace of the logarithm of a matrix. And now if I say that m equals 1 plus delta, where delta is a small number, you know how to do the Taylor series of the logarithm of 1 plus delta, and that tells you the answer. So, okay, so I'm not going to do the, I mean, this is something that you can definitely do. This is, and what you get is the divergence of the vector field, okay? So in this equation, I'm just going to plug this in. So I get 1 plus 2 over d, divergence of the vector field, times eta mu nu. So I have done almost nothing. I'm specializing the symmetry equation to infinitesimal transformations. And we're going to look for the infinitesimal one. So all I have to do is to solve the equation at order zeta. At order zeta naught, zeta to the zero, it's a trivial equation. It just tells you that eta equals zeta. So at order zeta, you get the following equation. You get the d mu. So you have to just keep the linear term here and the linear term here in the cross product, right? So you get equals 2 over d. D zeta eta mu nu. So the infinitesimal transformations are the solutions of this equation. And this equation has a name, it's called the conformal Killing equation. Now, if this term was zero, this would be the equation that determines the symmetries, the isometries of Minkowski space, okay? It would be called the Killing equation. If this guy was zero, this would be called the Killing equation, but since this is a conformal factor, we call it the conformal Killing equation. Any questions about this? Okay, so now let me give you some intuition about, so now the goal will be to find all functions, all vector field zeta that solve this equation, okay? But in order to orient ourselves, I will do one step back and solve that equation for the isometries and kind of highlight a cute way to think about it. So one way you can try to parameterize the most general solution is by saying zeta, I write it as a polynomial of the x's, right? I have a, it could be x to the 0, x to 1 power, x squared, x cubed, and so on. That would be one way to try to solve the problem by writing it in terms of a power series in the coordinates. So let's look first in the case of a Poincaré. So here the equation would be just this, right? There is no right-hand side because it preserves the metric, okay? Now, something that you can derive from this equation that will be very helpful. Oh, by the way, one thing I should say is that I believe you have access to some notes in the Wikipedia or somewhere. And so some of the things, the details that I may skip are there if you want to read them there. It's not very useful if I do like high school arithmetic in the blackboard, but I will do some. So one thing you can do now is you can take the defining, so this would be the Killing vector equation. That defines the symmetries of Minkowski space, the isometries of Minkowski space. So one thing you can do is you can take the derivative of this equation. Let me take the rho derivative of this equation. So I have d mu d rho zeta nu plus d rho d nu zeta mu equals 0. Okay. Now let me do the following thing. Let me write this equation exchanging mu and rho. Okay. Now I use the fact that partial derivatives commute, so this guy doesn't change. But here I do something. And now I'm going to exchange mu and nu. Let's see if I don't make a gigantic mess, but sorry. D rho zeta mu plus d rho d mu zeta nu equals 0, okay? Now let me look at this for 1 second. Okay, let me take I already made something weird here.
What is the second?
Sorry? So this is the equation where I swapped rho and mu. Actually, no, here I did something stupid. Rho and mu. Here I should have swapped rho and mu. Okay, let me try again. From here, right? So I have d mu d nu zeta rho plus d. This doesn't change, right? Because the partial derivatives don't change. Okay, let me try now again.
You need to have partial rho
with it.
You have zeta.
Where? Oh, sorry, am I missing? Yes, sorry, yes. You mean that it should be like that? Yeah. Okay, so. So let me add these two equations. Okay, yeah, so let's add these two equations and subtract this one. So this guy is cancelled by this guy, correct? I mean, you have to check that I know how to do arithmetic in the blackboard. This, and then this guy is cancelled by this guy, right? And I just have this plus this, well, it's twice the same thing. So from here, we conclude that Poincaré, infinitesimal Poincaré transformation, the vector field obeys this equation. So what does this tell us in the language I was saying before? That where you can think of parametrizing your vector field as a polynomial in the coordinates. It tells us that for Poincaré transformations, the infinitesimal vector field is at most linear in the coordinates, right? Because the second derivative kills it. So it tells you the most general vector field is, so let me write it, I mean, a nu plus omega, okay, right, mu nu x nu. And this is what you know, this is the Poincaré vector field. Sorry, the translation. And this would be the Lorentz rotation. Okay? So naively, you would have thought that it could be any nonlinear function of x, but actually, it's at most a linear function of x. So using the same, a similar logic, and you can see the details in the notes. You can take this equation and play a similar game by taking derivatives and being slightly clever about how you add and subtract equations to arrive at the following interesting result that proves that the set of conformal transformations is finite dimensional, okay, at least in dimensions higher than 2. So by a very similar kind of logic, by essentially taking derivatives of this equation, you can prove that if, okay, and we're going to call a psi that solves this a conformal killing vector, okay? Just like that guy is a killing vector. So psi is a killing vector, a conformal killing vector, if it is annihilated by the third derivative of zeta. Okay. So that immediately tells you that the set of transformations is finite dimensional because there is a finite set of polynomials you can write down that are at most quadratic in the coordinates. Okay. So yeah, from this point of view, that's why I like it, this point of view, is that it's kind of a mild generalization of what you know about Poincaré transformations. Okay. Good. So what it says is that it's a finite dimensional space. For d bigger than 2, but it's exactly infinite dimensional for d equals 2. Okay, so maybe that I can say something quickly about this. Why? So let's look at this equation for d equals 2, two space-time dimensions. Okay, and let's look at this equation so let's go to d equals 2. Now when mu and nu equals 1, what you have is that d1 zeta 1 equals d2 zeta 2. Do you see that? It's very important that the factor here is just 1. There is a cancellation between the gradient term and the left-hand side, okay? And for mu equals 1, nu equals 2, you find, so the right-hand side now will be 0, right? Because the metric is diagonal. And what you get is that d1 zeta 2 equals minus d2 zeta 1. Okay. So these are the equations that whose solutions determine the conformal killing vectors of two-dimensional space. Do you know the name of these equations? It's a Cauchy-Riemann equations. Which you can write down in a way by defining z to be x1 plus ix2. You can write down as the anti-holomorphic derivative of zeta equals 0. Where zeta is a complex combination of zeta 1 and zeta 2. Okay. So that means that in two dimensions, any holomorphic vector field is a conformal killing vector. So in two dimensions, and that's why in two dimensions we can just essentially solve completely the problem of two-dimensional conformal field theories is because the number of symmetries the number of conformal symmetries in two dimensions is infinite dimensional. Okay. Now, one thing I should mention is that there's an infinite number of holomorphic vector fields in two dimensions, but actually the all vector fields except a finite number of them have a singularity somewhere in the complex plane. So it either blows up at infinity or will have a pole or something. Okay. So the set of globally defined, in the sense that it has no singularity anywhere in the complex plane, in two dimensions is still finite dimensional. Okay. Good. So now we can just write down what the most general conformal killing vector is in these space-time dimensions. It's the most general quadratic polynomial in the coordinates. So let's just write it down. And I'm going to organize it in a way that is convenient. So a conformal Killing vector will have a term that is order zero, a mu, a term that's linear, x nu. There's another term that's linear. And then there's a more obnoxious quadratic term. So this is the most general thing you can write down that's quadratic in the axis. And the index structure is fixed by writing the most general quadratic term and putting it back into the equation. It determines the precise quadratic dependence. Okay. So what are these various things? So this guy is associated to what? To translations, right? So we're going to associate this transformation to p mu. This guy is associated to Lorentz transformations, which we, I don't know how you call it, but okay, let's call them m mu nu. So that's translations, that's Lorentz transformations. Okay, this is exactly what I did here, right? Now, what is this guy? A vector field that essentially rescales the point, that's a scale transformation or dilatation. So we're going to, the generator of that transformation, we're going to call it D, okay? For dilatation. And this more funny looking one that's parametrized by this number B mu. That's called the special conformal transformation. Okay. Good. So now let's count how many parameters there are. So there are D parameters here. How many Lorentz parameters there are? There are D, D minus 1 over 2, right? Because the Lorentz generators are generators of S of D, which is have this dimension. There is one dilatation, and then there are D special conformal transformations. So the dimension of the conformal algebra, if you add these things up, I didn't make a mistake, is D plus 2, D plus 1 divided by 2 dimensional conformal algebra. Okay? And as I promised in the first lecture, in the first lecture, I discussed, well, Poincaré, I didn't really discuss because we already know about it. I discussed dilatation or scale transformations. And what this analysis that I just shown is that a conformal field theory has an extra generator, which is this funny looking one, a special conformal transformation, that it's hard to have a very clear intuition about, but we will have one soon. Oh, no, actually, there's a clear intuition about it. And maybe you can think about it privately. You know, you can think of a translation as something that moves things near the origin, but keeps infinity fixed, right? Because if you shift infinity by one, it's still infinity. This guy actually does exactly the opposite. It's a transformation that keeps the origin fixed, but moves things near infinity. Okay? And we will you can think about it if you look at the equations. Okay, but this is still so far kinematics. I just told you what the Killing vector fields, what the conformal Killing vectors are, the most general conformal Killing vector. Now we have to determine the conformal algebra. So how do you, given a collection of vector fields that generate an action on space-time, how do you find the associated algebra? Well, what you do is you look at the Lie brackets. Okay, so we're going to determine the conformal algebra. By looking at the commutator of transformations. So you're going to have two transformations, zeta 1, zeta 2. These are two conformal Killing vectors, and they're going to be a collection of parameters, a1, omega 1, blah, blah, blah. And then another one, a2, omega 2, and so on. We know that the commutator of two vector fields is a vector field, OK? And by definition, since this is a Lie algebra of symmetries, if these two guys are conformal Killing vectors, this guy will have to be a conformal Killing vector, okay? So implies that this guy is also a conformal Killing vector, okay? So now what you can do is a very simple. Remember that okay, so in case that was not completely clear, so the conformal Killing vector is this, right? Okay. And zeta mu is what I wrote there. So now you know how to take, well, I presume that you know how to take the Lie bracket of two things, okay? You just have to take some derivatives, okay? And by doing this and knowing that p mu is associated to a mu, m mu nu is associated to omega mu nu, and so on and so on and so on, you can write down the Lie algebra, the conformal algebra, okay? So let's start first with the part that you already know. Let's look at the Lorentz generators. So if you the commutator of two Lorentz transformations gives you what? Sorry? Just say it and you'll get it right. This is impossible to make a mistake on. I mean, the indices have to match, right? So, you know, the number of indices on the left and on the right have to match. So that already tells you that the only possibility is that you can only get a Lorentz rotation. So I mean, I'm sure you've seen this before, but let me just write it. So m nu sigma, and then three other terms that you need so that the right-hand side is antisymmetric. In mu nu and rho sigma. Have you seen this before? Okay. So, I mean, I can write it more explicitly, but I think you know what this is, okay? Now, what is a, I mean, this is just the Poincaré algebra. I'm writing the Poincaré algebra, okay? So what is the commutator of a Lorentz transformation with a translation? What do you get here? So if you rotate a vector, what do you get? Another vector, right? Okay, so on the right-hand side, you're going to get also a Lorentz a vector. So, and again, you have to make it antisymmetric in mu and nu. Okay, so let me write it. I won't be lazy. I'll write it here, p mu, okay? Good. And this is just the Poincaré. And of course, translations commute, right? You know that. So I'm only writing, of course, the non-trivial commutators, but as you know, translations commute. Now there is another generator here that has an index of a vector, right? K mu. So just from that considerations alone, you know immediately, but you can do it if from this first principles point of view, that if you take the commutator of Lorentz transformations with a special conformal, you should get the vector back. Okay, so it's almost identical to this transformation, but when you replace momentum by a special conformal generator. Okay, so it tells you that a special conformal generator transforms as a vector under Lorentz transformations. That's the physical meaning of this equation. Now there are the interesting ones. And this is, I'll leave it an exercise to check. This is completely straightforward to check. That the commutator of dilatations, which is the generator of a scale transformation. And remember in the first lecture, I said that we're going to care a lot about the eigenvalues of the dilatation generator acting on the operators. These are the things that determine the critical exponents of the CFT. So what you find is that the commutator of DMP, you get a minus IP and a plus IK. Okay. Does this remind you of something that you've seen before? A generator that, I mean, this looks like the harmonic oscillator, where D is the Hamiltonian, this is A, and this is A dagger. So if you wish P, you can think of K mu as a lowering operator, and P mu as a raising operator, and D as a Hamiltonian. So when you construct the Hilbert space or the representation theory of the conformal algebra, P mu will be like a raising operator, okay? Because it increases the eigenvalue of D by one, okay? And the one that's more tricky to figure out, but again, follows from this exercise, which I encourage you to at least verify some of them, is the commutator of P with Q. Well, I mean, there are only two things that you can really write down. There are two indices on the left, okay? And what is available to me? What's available to me is these letters, right? The generators and the Lorentz metric, okay? So the only thing that you can only write down is this. The factors of two and so on, that comes from a computation, but you can either get the metric times a scalar, which is the dilatation operator, or you can get a Lorentz rotation. So something that's symmetric in mu and nu, and something that's anti-symmetric in mu and nu. No, you couldn't have written anything else. Okay. So this set of transformations define. So this is it. Everything else is zero. Okay. So I think that, so. Hopefully you have developed an intuition about this. So D is a scalar. It's a Lorentz scalar. It has no indices. It commutes with Lorentz transformations. It's a raising operator. So it's a Hamiltonian, and p mu is a raising operator, and k mu is a lowering operator. K mu is a Lorentz vector. It has one index. And the final one is that the raising and lowering operator give you back the Hamiltonian plus a Lorentz rotation. And this is the conformal algebra. So any conformal field theory, okay, but we're still doing kinematics. We haven't talked about fields yet, but in a conformal field theory, the theory has to represent on the Hilbert space and on the operators this symmetry, this algebra. Okay. Now let me write this algebra in a way that at least we will be able to recognize it as something that you've seen before. So here one has to be use a little bit has a bit of an insight. And I'm going to do is just organize the generators in the following way. So let me. So we're starting d-dimensional. We're in d dimensions, right? So I'm going to introduce two fake coordinates. So let me define x capital M. It's going to x mu, which are our space-time coordinates, the d-dimensional space-time coordinates that we've been discussing, plus two additional coordinates xd, xd plus one. Okay. And this describes Minkowski. Okay, now let me make the following identifications, which I'm pulling out of the hat right now. So I'm gonna say that when, so, and I'm gonna make an identification of this anti-symmetric matrix in terms of the generators there. So L mu nu, I'm gonna identify with M mu nu. L, D, D plus one, so the two extra coordinates I'm gonna identify with the dilatation operator. Yeah, that's a bit confusing. It's not, this is the operator, I don't know. Okay. Then I have to, so I've told you like the two blocks, the Minkowski block and this block. Now I have to tell you the off-diagonal elements. The off-diagonal elements I'm gonna identify with L mu D is one half P mu plus K mu. And L mu D plus one with one half P mu minus K mu, okay? Now imagine I compute the commutator of LMN with LPQ. Using this identification and using these commutators, right? The thing that's remarkable is that what you get here is this. Plus things that will make the guarantee that this is anti-symmetric in the exchange of MN and PQ, where this eta is a Lorentz-like metric in D plus two dimensions, right? Because the indices of M go from two more than the space-time metric. It's a metric that's, let me call it eta hat. Eta hat is going to be the usual Minkowski metric on the first D coordinates, right? Diagonal metric with eigenvalues minus 1, 1, 1. And the last one is a plus and a minus in the entry D and D plus 1. Okay? So I don't expect you that you have followed the algebra from that to that, that this is true. But if you believe me, what I said, what does this tell you? I mean, do you know what name do we associate to this Lie algebra? It's actually the Lie algebra that preserves the Lorentz metric, this Lorentz metric, okay? That's by definition the orthogonal group. But now this is not the orthogonal group. It's the orthogonal group that preserves a metric that has two negative eigenvalues and the rest positive eigenvalues. So in Diels-Minkowski, you would say this, right? You would have this, and then what's the Lie algebra that preserves this? Is SO1, D minus 1, right? Now we're going to have SO2D. So it means that the conformal algebra, as an algebra, is isomorphic, is SO2D. So what we have discovered is that the conformal algebra actually can be written in a way of something that you have a good intuition about, which is SO Lie algebras, orthogonal Lie algebras. Okay. The only thing that's a bit peculiar is that it has two time-like components and these space-like components. Okay. Good. Now, the fact that the conformal algebra is SO2D played a very important, so I'll make just a small comment, played a very important role in kind of setting up the ADS-CST correspondence. So let me just say this is a small parenthesis about the ADS-CST correspondence. So we have a CFT in D dimensions, space time dimensions, and ADS in D plus one dimensions, okay? So a zero order, check that the ASCF, whenever you have an equality of things, the first thing you should always check is that the symmetries match. If the symmetries don't match, you're wrong. You have to go home and, okay, try again. So here we already said that CFTD has the symmetry of SO2, D, right?
So let me just keep the SO2, D minus 1?
No, because I added two extra coordinates. So it's one time-like and one space-like. Yeah. So now you can ask, what are the symmetries of ADS? Okay, that. So you know what the symmetries of Minkowski space are? They are the Poincaré symmetry. Now, ADS space is essentially it's hyperbolic space and can be represented by a hyperboloid embedded into Minkowski space, a higher dimensional Minkowski space. And the point is that the symmetries, the isometries of ADS D plus 1 are precisely SO2D. And maybe we'll do an exercise to understand. I mean, I think you would, even instead of Anti de Sitter, I would talk about the sphere. You know that the symmetry of a d-dimensional sphere is? You know? It's SOD plus 1, right? You can write the sphere as a sum of squares equals 1, right? You can embed in one-dimensional higher space, right? So with ADS, it's almost exactly the same, but has negative curvature. So there's a minus sign somewhere, okay? But then you look at the equation that defines the hyperboloid, just like the equation that defines the sphere, and it's precisely this one, okay? So the fact that the conformal algebra, which is the symmetry of the CFT that lives at the boundary, is SO2D, matches the symmetries of ADS, that's kind of a first order sanity check that this is not crazy, that the correspondence is not crazy, okay? And the fact that it is SO2, of course, played an important role in making that correspondence, okay? Good. So now let me, in the last few minutes, let me say, so far we've been discussing the infinitesimal transformations that are connected to the identity, okay? Now let's discuss transformations that are not connected to the identity. And there's going to be a very important one that we will use over and over. So someone already mentioned before that you're already familiar from Poincaré. Parity and time reversal are two examples of Poincaré transformations that are not connected to the identity. And therefore, okay, by another theorem, these are discrete transformations. There is no current or charge associated to them. It's a discrete transformation, so there is no current or charge, but it still acts on the Hilbert space and operators and blah blah blah. Okay. So now let's look at transformations. So discrete conformal transformations. So I'm going to define a transformation I, which is an inversion, that maps x mu to x mu divided by x squared. Well, this transformation, can someone tell me why this transformation is not connected to the identity? What happens to a point very, very near the origin? It goes very far, right? So it's not a small transformation, it's a large transformation. And what happens if I apply this transformation twice? I go back to myself. So I square equals one. I mean, you can check explicitly, okay? Just do it twice. So that means that this is a Z2 transformation. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a discrete group of order 2. Okay. Now, one thing you can check is it's a conformal transformation. It's conformal. What would it mean to say that it's conformal? I'll probably erase the equation. But that equation that I wrote for the conformal transformation with the Jacobians, you have to check that it obeys it and that the Jacobian factor, the scale factor, e to the omega x is 1 over x squared. Okay? Another way of saying that it's not connected to the identity is that it maps the unit sphere, the unit ball, sorry. It maps the inside of the unit ball to the outside of the unit ball. Okay? So it's definitely not a continuous transformation. And the other thing is that the Z2 transformation, so it's an order 2 transformation, just like time reversal or parity is an order 2 transformation. You map x to minus x. Okay. Now, one very interesting statement that is true is that the conformal group, not algebra, the conformal group is generated by concatenating translations with inversions. And one way you can convince yourself about that is the following. And one thing I should have said also is that inversion changes orientation of space-time. Just like parity changes orientation of space-time, okay? Now, something that I want you to check is that if I take an inversion, I do a translation and I do an inversion back, if this statement is correct, I should get a generator, a conformal generator of the Lie algebra, right? And the thing you can check from the explicit knowledge of the vectors is that what you get here is a special conformal transformation, okay? So from this analysis that you can very easily check, you find that inversions plus translations gives you special conformal transformations. Now I know, I'm almost done, because I know that if I take the special conformal transformation with the translation, I'm going to generate the dilatation, okay? So I've generated everything, essentially. Good. So one thing that's important to say, of course, is that just like in usual relativistic quantum, the ones that you've been studying so far, so any relativistic quantum field theory has to be invariant under the connected component of the Lorentz group, right? But a quantum field theory need not be invariant under parity or time reversal. I mean, the standard model is not invariant under parity, for example, famously. So a conformal field theory, by definition, is necessarily invariant under the connected component of the conformal group, but need not be invariant under inversions. Okay, that's something important to keep in mind. Okay. And actually, there's something that maybe since I have maybe in the last minute or so, I can tell you something more about the global properties of the conformal group. Just like the Poincaré group breaks into different disconnected components, the one that's connected to the identity and the other components that essentially have to do with time reversal and parity, you can look at the conformal group. Has four disconnected components. And actually, the way you determine the components is essentially by looking at the. So I said that a conformal transformation is an element of SO2,D. So SO2,D is a D plus two dimensional antisymmetric matrix. A transformation is a D plus two dimensional antisymmetric matrix, OK? A D plus two matrix. Now, looking at the determinant of this matrix, very similar to what you do in for Poincaré, is a determinant. So you have the determinant of the 2x2 block, and the determinant of the whatever it is, the other block, I guess d-dimensional block. Depending on the sign of this thing, let me make sure I get the signs right. So when the two signs are plus, you get a matrix lambda, and this defines the conformal transformations connected to the identity. So, and these lambdas are the finite transformations associated to the solutions of the conformal Killing vector we've been describing. Okay. In the case of if you were doing Poincaré, this would be or Lorentz. This would be what it's called the proper orthogonous Lorentz subgroup. Okay. So this is the analog of that for the conformal. If the determinant is minus here and plus here, the most general transformation of this type. So this component is generated by taking inversions times. A conformal transformation connected to the identity. And in fact, also parity, the usual parity that you know, times lambda is also in this component. Okay. And actually, a cute exercise that you can try to prove is that a theory, so parity and inversion are related by a lambda transformation of this type. Okay. So the theory is a CFT is invariant under inversion, if and only if it's invariant under parity.
So the I above is different from the Ackermann inversion, right? They
connected to the, oh, sorry, yes. Yeah, thank you. So this component essentially is the component that knows about parity or equivalently inversion, okay? Then this is the other component where this is a plus and this is a minus. That's a component that has to do with time reversal. So it's a component where you have a time reversal transformation times a general connected conformal transformation. And the final one, minus minus, is where you have time reversal times inversion times conformal transformation. Okay. So a conformal field theory has to necessarily be invariant under this, by definition. Whether it's invariant under those, that's a separate question. Okay. And there are conformal field theories that are invariant under those and some that are not invariant under those. Okay. Yes. OK, so this essentially ends the discussion of the geometry associated to conformal transformations, how it acts on space-time, what algebra of symmetries and group they generate. And in the next lecture, we're going to see how whenever you have a symmetry in a system, in a quantum system, you have to understand how that symmetry is realized on your Hilbert space and variables. So that's what we're going to do, I guess, next Tuesday. Thanks.